Welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, June 16th. I'm Dagna, and I'll be reading the local news in the Siouxland area today. We'll have a quick recap of the weather for the Siouxland area. Today, it was predicted high of 94 with a low tonight of 72. It'll be partly sunny, windy, and hot and humid. Wednesday will be partly sunny, windy, and hot with a high of 94 and a low of 73. Thursday is not going to be as hot and will possibly have an afternoon thunderstorm. High of 86 with a low of 61. Friday could be having a thunderstorm in spots in the morning with a high of 84 and a low of 63. And Saturday is mostly cloudy with possible thunderstorms, a high of 80 and a low of 61. And that concludes a recap of the weather for the Siouxland area. We'll now have the mini editorial from the front page, and that is written today by Frank Gruber of Sioux City. And Frank writes, "Young people, please assist the elderly and ill to cope with the increasing temptations now that society is opening. Above all, wear masks and social distance when with them." And again, that was written by Frank Gruber of Sioux City. Our first front page story is from the City Council meeting last night. The headline is Sioux City Police Headquarters Getting Money to Remodel Entrance. And this is a story by Brett Hayworth of the Sioux City Journal. The Sioux City Police Department headquarters entrance will soon be altered to improve safety by providing an area for security screenings prior to entry into the building. The Sioux City Council, in its weekly Monday meeting, passed two measures to construct a covered vestibule at the entrance by 2021, including officially accepting a U.S. Department of Justice Coronavirus Emergency Supplemental Funding grant of $133,995. The other measure was approving a plan to pay FEH Design of Sioux City $28,235 for the design tasks related to the project. Police Captain Lisa Clay said the project could begin by fall, and construction of a covered entry vestibule would update the entrance doors for the first time in 30 years. Having a more secure facility to allow controlled access to the police and fire headquarters will enhance public safety and safety by maximizing the utilization remote access to communicate and screen citizens, allowing a more safety-oriented approach to social distancing and risk mitigation for employees and residents, Clay said in a meeting memo. Clay said community spread of the novel coronavirus in March moved police officials to cut off public access to the building, and the front doors to the main lobby were locked for the first time ever. "Our lobby was accessible and has been utilized 24 hours a day, 365 days of the year. Following the positive COVID-19 diagnosis of 10 staff members in rapid succession, the need for building modifications in the interest of employee and citizen safety became paramount," Clay said. In April, Police Chief Rex Mueller told the Journal he was one of the infected employees, and others included a police captain, two lieutenants, a sergeant, a police officer, and some civilian employees. "In investigating changing the entrance," she said, "some double doors were found to be leaking heat or air conditioning, and there was a desire to extend the entrance closer to the street by adding the vestibule. That portion could include sliding doors and will provide a waiting area out of the elements for building visitors." Clay said the more modern entrance would have speakers and cameras so that both police and fire department staff could remotely observe, speak with, and screen people coming into the building. An added bonus to this structure would be lobby security from individuals who may seek to engage officers or staff in a violent encounter. In the past several years, multiple police agencies have dealt with active shooters in their lobby. Our next front page story is headlined, "As Protests Fade, How Do Civil Rights Activists Keep Passion for Change Burning?" And this story was written by Nick Heitrek of the Sioux City Journal. In the days immediately after the May 25th death of George Floyd, news loops contained a steady stream of photos, videos, and stories from racial justice protests in major cities across the country. Rallies and chants of Black Lives Matter were common in much smaller cities too. For three nights in a row, protesters gathered outside Sioux City's police headquarters. Rallies have taken place in Spencer, Storm Lake, and other Siouxland communities. The emotions of all these protests for racial equality will cool, as we've already begun to see. Many of us will move on, figuring that activists made their point, the legislature took action, and everything's good. But the effort is far from over, local activists say. They're challenged to make sure the issue doesn't become yesterday's news. The outpouring of support was great, but it's the work that is done in the weeks, months, and years ahead that will lead to change. Monique Scarlett, a Sioux City School Board member and founder of Unity in the Community, a group that encourages partnership with community members and law enforcement, says, "My personal perspective is now we must look forward. We cannot let the past keep us hostage. We have to move forward with focus, tenacity, courage, and hope for the future." She and Ike Rayford, president of the local chapter, the NAACP, are encouraged by what they've seen in Sioux City and beyond since Floyd died after a Minneapolis police officer knelt on his neck for more than 8 minutes. In addition to the aforementioned protests outside the Sioux City Police Department, community and faith leaders have gathered for peaceful public events at the Law Enforcement Center and at Cook Park. Similar events have taken place across the country. Some included violence, many did not. "There's a sense of enough is enough," said Scarlett. This time people are saying, "We've begged, we've been martyred, this time we're going to make change happen." The result, Rayford said, seems to be that police chiefs, mayors, governors, and other elected officials are now giving more than lip service to those seeking change. Rayford says, "It feels like finally they're listening. It feels different. Before, there was no hope. Now I do feel like people are truly listening." What changed? Rayford believes the video of Floyd's death made an impact. Past incidents that led to protests in cities such as Ferguson, Missouri, and Baltimore were never seen. This time, there was no deniability. Rayford said, "We saw a man dead. This time we saw it. Now people are starting to see it. They're seeing it and they believe it. And now that the movement has their attention, it's time to hold it." The noise from the protests will fade, but the call for change must remain loud and clear. The challenge is how. There are many ways, of course, and they begin as early as elementary school, Scarlett said. As a school board member, she said she'll continue to promote education so children understand civics, understand what's going on in the world around them, so that as they get older, they have a sense of direction. That leads to involvement. Scarlett urges people of all ages to join and become active in organizations seeking change. It includes registering to vote, learning what candidates stand for, and then casting a ballot. Public officials, Rayford said, must be held to their word. If they promise to meet with community groups to find solutions, to take action, Rayford said he'll continue to ask them about it until it's done. Fortunately, Rayford and Scarlett said, good things already are happening in Sioux City. Police leaders and officers show up for block parties and public forums. Civil rights groups and police chief Rex Mueller all want every officer outfitted with body cameras. Rayford said that the NAACP continues to push for a citizen review board to not only review applicants to the police department, but also to hold officers accountable in cases of alleged misconduct. "The only thing we've always said is we want the police to police themselves," Rayford said. "In Sioux City, I am so fortunate to have a police chief that's willing to sit down and have a conversation. I am happy to live in a city where I can brag on our police department and I can brag on our city council." Sioux City has a chance to be an example for bigger cities, Scarlett said. "It starts in our hometown and then grows abroad." She and Rayford are encouraged by what they've seen in the days since Floyd's death. Police departments are outlawing chokeholds and other tactics. Mayors and city councils are discussing reorganizing police departments. Rayford said, "In my gut, I feel that a change is coming and we're in the process of it." All those protests that we witnessed the past couple of weeks may just have been the beginning steps of that process. It's nearly certain they won't be the last. Our next story headline is Change in Plans, Sioux City Pools Will Open to Public Swimming. Mayor Bob Scott opened the Monday meeting of the Sioux City Council with news that many residents wanted to hear. The city pools will be open in a week for public swimming. Previously, city officials had announced pools would not open for regular operations this summer because of the coronavirus pandemic. The plan was to limit usage of pools to adult fitness classes and swimming lessons for children on select times of the day, beginning in late June. However, on Wednesday, Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds lifted COVID-19 restrictions on the state's swimming pools and water parks, so Scott said the city would open its fleet of pools on June 22nd. Scott said a distance of 6 feet is recommended in the pool and on the decks to maintain a degree of social distancing. He added that wearing masks on the pool deck is highly encouraged, although they should not be worn by people who are in the water. A few minutes later, the city issued a press release on the opening of the pools, while noting the city splash pads will not open for the summer. Additionally, the slide at Riverside pool will open. One key element is that all swimmers must sign in with their names for information that will be used by staff for contact tracing in the event a positive case is confirmed. Other Northwest Iowa pools that previously planned to be closed have opened sooner than the timing in Sioux City. The Sioux Center Water Park opened on Friday. The pool season in Sioux City will last 6 weeks through August 2nd at Leif Erickson, Lewis, and Riverside pools. The swimming sessions will be held with an unspecified limited capacity. On Mondays through Fridays, open swimming will be held from 3 p.m. to 6 p.m., and on weekends, the three-hour session will be from 12:30 to 3:30 p.m., then again from 4 to 7 p.m. The release said staff have developed policies and procedures in consultation with Siouxland District Health to provide a safe environment for pool users. New cleaning procedures will be in place, such as pool workers cleaning high-touched surfaces every half hour, with deep cleaning happening before and after each session. Guests are encouraged to maintain 6 feet of distance from others and use hand sanitizers before entering and leaving the facility. Now we have another story from the Sioux City Council meeting from Monday evening. This headline, Step 2, Garbage Rates in Sioux City Now Closer to Increase. All that remains is one more city council vote in order to increase the garbage collection rates paid by city residents. The Sioux City Council, in a Monday meeting, unanimously approved the second reading of ordinance changes authorizing an increase in the city's garbage rates. The council passed a first reading last month, and three readings must be held before any ordinance can pass. None of the council members spoke on the merits of the garbage rate increases as they voted for it. Under the new proposed rates, which would go into effect on July 1st, the fee for a 90-gallon tote would increase from $16.63 to $17.50. The extra container fee from $3.05 to $4.16, and solid waste stickers from $1.08 to $1.15. According to documents filed with the city, the collection rate increases will accommodate the increase in contract costs payable to Gill Hauling and are necessary to maintain compliance with the city fund balance policy. In February 2019, the council unanimously voted to increase the base rate for solid waste collection from $16.30 to $16.63. The extra container fee from $2.99 to $3.05, and the cost of a solid waste sticker from $1 to $1.08. The senior discount rate was discontinued because city staff said it put the city at risk for a class action lawsuit. Before that increase, collection rates had not been raised since January of 2016. A new feature will allow small volume users to apply for a 65-gallon container in lieu of the current 90-gallon container. Mayor Bob Scott told a city resident who called into the Monday meeting, the proposed rate for the 65-gallon container is $14.95. City staff is working with Gill Hauling to develop a plan to phase in the 65-gallon option. Additionally, in the meeting, the council approved an application for $154,608 in tax incentives to a Metro business over 10 years through the Iowa's Targeted Job Program. The approval was done to aid a rapidly growing clinical research company to move its operation from Dakota Dunes to an existing building on Sioux City's east side by July 1st. Meridian Clinical Research, which is conducting investigative trials on a vaccine intended to protect against the novel coronavirus, has decided to lease and renovate an existing building at 4802 Sunnybrook Drive. As part of the project, Meridian will retain 10 employees, hire 27 new employees, and invest over $2.4 million. That projection was done to show the financial impact that could come from being in the Targeted Jobs Program. The Morningside facility, which formerly housed a CNOS clinic, will be four times larger than Meridian's current Dakota Dunes site, according to documents filed with the city. The new location will enable Meridian to service more clinical research trials simultaneously, bring on additional specialized therapeutic areas for studies, and create an on-site lab and a new participant recruitment call center. The urgency of the move and significant increase in scale has been predicated by COVID-19 and the company's role as a premier site partner in administering vaccine trials for numerous pharmaceutical companies developing vaccines to control the virus, according to a council meeting memo. Our next story headline is Vice President Mike Pence to visit North Iowa, tour with the Winnebago Industries. Vice President Mike Pence will travel to North Iowa on Tuesday, heading to Forest City to tour Winnebago Industries and speak with its employees. Pence will land at the Mason City Airport at around 10:45 a.m. and head to lunch at an undisclosed location with Governor Kim Reynolds. The governor's staff did not immediately return requests for information on the governor's Tuesday schedule, so it's unclear whether she'll accompany him to Forest City. The vice president is scheduled to address Winnebago's employees around 2 p.m. Winnebago Industry Public Relations Specialist Sam Jeffson said on Monday that Pence is interested in learning how the company handled the economic impact from COVID-19. "We did have to postpone manufacturing for a time period there and suspend that while keeping some other areas of our company open, but we did postpone some manufacturing." The company had stopped production near the end of March, and production in facilities like the one in Forest City did not resume until the beginning of May. During that period, Winnebago Industries provided base pay and benefits to its 5,000 employees for the first 2 weeks. Winnebago Forest City employees also made medical masks for Mercy One North Iowa using its Stitchcraft facility, which houses industrial sewing capabilities to produce soft goods for Winnebago motorhome production, such as seats, pillows, and draperies. Though production in Forest City resumed May 4th, about 7 weeks after it was suspended, production employees did not have their wage payments extended, but the company still paid for the medical and dental insurance. Employees are required to follow safety protocols such as social distancing, strict sanitation practices, and daily employee health checks, whether working physically on campus or off-site. Now that the heat of summer is moving in, Jeffson said the company is seeing some momentum and interest in its consumer base, with people wanting to get outdoors and enjoy the RV lifestyle. Jefferson said they're excited to show the vice president what they do and tell him how they got through the economic and health impact of the pandemic. "Obviously, this is quite a historic event for a company to have the sitting U.S. vice president come to our facility, and we're excited to showcase what we do and share our story." Focus on Rural America co-founder and former Iowa Lieutenant Governor Patty Judge said on Monday that Pence's visit to Iowa, including a stop at Winnebago Industries, would be a fantastic opportunity for him to see what is happening to the rural economy, more specifically to struggling ethanol plants across the state. "A Winnebago tour to rural communities could take him to ethanol plants that are suffering thanks to small refinery waivers for oil and gas, coupled with the impact of the coronavirus pandemic," she said. "I'm certain that struggling ethanol plants would welcome the vice president and any support to end the waivers and help the rural economy." Rural economies remain particularly vulnerable to the pandemic, as small refinery waivers and the coronavirus have forced 150 biofuel facilities to scale back or shut down. Pence is scheduled to return to Washington, D.C. Tuesday evening. We'll now move to the opinion page, and we have two letters to the editor today. Our first letter to the editor is written by Robert B. Deck of Sioux City, and he writes, "I am sick and tired of the media pushing the idea of a new normal and constantly telling us that the things will never be the same again. Why will things not be the same again? All it takes is for people to act normal again by stopping the historical security theater with the masks and the plexiglass. I am 72 years old and am quite confident that I can survive the Chinese flu. But if not, I am prepared to take the bullet for my children's and grandchildren's and country's freedom. The Constitution and the Bill of Rights are inalienable, period. It does not say these are your rights unless some experts or government officials determine it is not safe to let you have those rights, in which case they are no longer inalienable and can be arbitrarily taken away from you." This letter was written by Robert B. Deck of Sioux City. Our second letter to the editor is written by Nicole Hansen of Sioux City, and Nicole writes, "As an alumna of the Sioux City Community Schools who graduated high school 8 years ago, I believe our schools must do better to educate students on history and civics and address racism. When I was a student, our history classes focused exclusively on the history of white people, except for the occasional February where we would watch a documentary about MLK. Teaching only European history and the history of white people in America teaches children that only white history and white people matter. Our civics education was also woefully inadequate, teaching us only superficial information about the federal government and teaching us nothing about local politics or how to vote. Due to these deficiencies, I am urging the Sioux City Community School District to make public commitments to improve education and address systemic racism. First, the district needs to make public commitments to improve history education so that students are thoroughly educated on Black, Native American, African, Asian, Middle Eastern, Hispanic, and Latino history. Second, the district needs to make public commitments to improve civics education. Third, the district needs to make public commitments to holding listening sessions with current and past students of color in order to improve their experiences in our schools. Fourth, the district needs to make public commitments to hire more diverse faculty and staff that are representative of the Sioux City community so that all students feel represented." And this, again, was the letter written by Nicole Hansen of Sioux City. Now, our Tuesday topic today is written by Kim Van S., who is a Sioux Center, Iowa resident, and her topic is all mail voting. And she writes, "I have already given my notice to the Sioux City Auditor, to the Sioux County Auditor. If COVID-19 is still here, I will not be working the polls during the November 3rd election. And COVID, the unwanted guest, will likely still be among us, which means that I won't be a PEO, a precinct election official. My spouse won't be a PEO, and others will join us in saying no thank you to putting ourselves at risk. Normally, I enjoy working the polls and have done so for years, but working the primary on June 2nd was uncomfortable and scary. Though the auditor's office provided masks, gloves, and even face shields, about a third of the PEOs did not wear any personal protective equipment, nor did they maintain proper distancing from each other or the 957 voters who came to our polling location. I would not be surprised to learn that PEOs, most of whom are over 60, and voters were infected at the polls. Following Wisconsin's April 7th election, there were correlations between locations of high in-person voting and high virus transmission. As someone who lives with a person in an at-risk category for COVID, I had been physically distancing and using curbside service for months. Then I spent most of June 2nd in a room with people not protecting themselves or others. Stupid on my part. Never again. With people like me saying no, auditors will have an even more difficult time finding enough workers. Combine this factor with the large turnout expected in November. These issues are in addition to the inherent challenge of using volunteers to execute such an important civic function. I appreciate my fellow PEOs and their willingness to serve. But the truth is that their varying comfort level with technology and the fact that many of them work this gig only once every 4 years calls for consideration of a radical change. Republicans in the Iowa legislature seem disturbed that prior to the primary, Secretary of State Pate sent all registered voters an absentee ballot request form, but his actions decreased the face-to-face contacts at the polls and led to record participation in the Iowa primary. He is to be commended. For the November general election, however, we need to go a step further. Now is the time for Iowa and all states to send mail-in ballots to all registered voters. Contrary to what some loud voices are saying, credible research studies show that voter fraud related to mail-in ballots is negligible. 5 states, Colorado, Hawaii, Oregon, Washington, and Utah, already conduct all elections entirely by mail. My relative, who recently moved to Washington, can't imagine why you would go to the polls when you can vote by mail. Just like the fast and radical transitions many other organizations have had to make due to COVID, all Secretary of State should start preparing now for all mail elections in November, incorporating the security steps that experienced states have vetted. If Americans want high participations, which we should in a democracy, and high safety, haven't we had enough COVID deaths? This is the only voting system that makes any sense for November of 2020. And again, this was written by Kim Van S., who lives in Sioux Center, Iowa. Our next story is headlined, One More Sioux City Metro Person Dies from COVID-19. One more person has died from COVID-19 in the metro area as the Dakota County Health Department reported the death Monday, when Woodbury County moved past the 3,000 mark in the number of positive tests for the novel coronavirus. The age or gender of the person who died was not cited, and the number of deaths in Dakota County now stands at 32. The first positive case of the novel coronavirus in Dakota County was reported in mid-April, and now a combined 1,741 cases have been detected through tests. There were 2 new cases reported Monday by the Dakota County Health Department. In the metro, there have been 71 deaths when factoring those also in Woodbury County. As of Monday evening, Woodbury County had 3,009 positive cases of coronavirus and 39 deaths since the pandemic reached the area in the metro. According to a joint statement Monday, Mercy One Siouxland Medical Center and Unity Point Health St. Luke's are providing care for a combined 54 COVID-19 patients. That number is trending downward from late May, when there were routinely 80 to 90 patients in the 2 city hospitals. In the Monday release, Dakota County Health Department Director Natasha Richardson said through various phases of reopening that are happening in the county, residents should continue to carry out social distancing, wear a mask when in public, wash their hands often, and sanitize common use areas. For most people, the coronavirus causes only mild or moderate symptoms such as fever and cough. For some, especially older adults and people with existing health problems, it can cause more severe illnesses, including pneumonia. The vast majority of people recover from the virus. According to the World Health Organization, people with mild cases recover in about 2 weeks, while those with more severe ones can take 3 to 6 weeks to get better. You are listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, June 16th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now we'll turn to today's obituaries and death notices. Robert Bob L. Peckelder, and that's spelled P-E-K-E-L-D-E-R, of Sheldon, Iowa, 92, died Friday, June 12th. Arrangements by Andriga Funeral Home of Sheldon. Sioux City. Creola M. Lambing, 79, of Sioux City, passed away Tuesday, June 9th at Colonial Manor of Randolph, Nebraska. A private celebration of life was held by the family. Arrangements were under the direction of Waterbury Funeral Service of Sioux City. Creola Mae Lambing was born June 7, 1941 in Huntington, Nebraska, the daughter of J. and Florence Coop Constable. Creola knew James Lambing all her life. They married January 26, 1957. She is the love of James' life. To this union, five children were born: Steve, Jeffrey, Anne, James, and Jay. Creola worked many years in home health for St. Luke's. She really loved taking care of others, and she was very close with all her patients. She loved to spend time with her grandchildren during arts and crafts. They were very special to her. Creola enjoyed crocheting, reading her iPad, baking, but not cooking, puzzle books, and having company in her home. Cherokee, Iowa. Shannon J. Goth, 65, died Sunday, June 14th. Private funeral service will be June 18th at 10:30 a.m. at Greenwood Schubert Funeral Home in Cherokee. Burial will be at the Mount Calvary Cemetery in Cherokee. Public visitation will be June 17th starting at 4 p.m. at the funeral home. Service will also be on the funeral home site. Sioux City. Maria Navarro, 65, died Friday, June 12th. Service will be June 20th at 11 a.m. at Waterbury Funeral Service of Sioux City. Burial will be at the Graceland Park Cemetery. Visitation will be June 19th from 6 to 10 p.m. at the funeral home. Lamars, Iowa. James R. Schoenrock, 80, died Monday, June 15th. Arrangements by the Maurer Johnson Funeral Home of Lamars. Alta, Iowa. Lynn Johnson, 75, died Sunday, June 14th. Private family service will be June 19th at 10:30 a.m. at the St. Paul Lutheran Church in Alta due to the COVID-19 levels in the county. Public burial will be June 19th at 11:30 p.m. at the Woodlawn Cemetery in Alta. Visitation will be June 18th from 4 to 8 p.m. Arrangements by the Fratke Jensen Funeral Home, Alta. Ida Grove, Iowa. Florence Marie Wunschel, 93, died Saturday, June 13th. Private family service will be held at the Christensen Van Houten Funeral Home in Ida Grove. Burial will be at the Sacred Heart Catholic Cemetery, Ida Grove. And that concludes the obituaries for Tuesday. We'll now move to some brief items of local interest. Suspects sought in Walgreens robberies, Sioux City. The Sioux City Police Department is seeking a man as a suspect in the robbery of the two Walgreens stores over recent days, in which police said he brandished a knife to steal cash and merchandise. In a Monday release, police said they are searching for Chasten Tyndall, 29, of Sioux City, as the primary suspect in the robberies. On Friday morning, police responded to a robbery at the Walgreens in the 4500 block of Morningside Avenue, where the man threatened a clerk with a knife and stole several items from the store. About 14 hours later, a second robbery occurred Saturday in the early afternoon at another Walgreens at 1900 Hamilton Boulevard by a man who looked similar to the robber in the first incident. He again displayed a knife and stole cash from the register and merchandise. The release said no one was injured during either robbery, and detectives have now identified Tyndall as a suspect in those crimes. Anyone with information on Tyndall's whereabouts or additional information on these robberies is encouraged to call the department's non-emergency number 712-279-6960 or Crime Stoppers at 712-258-8477. Ex-Kingsley Police Chief pleads guilty, Lamars, Iowa. The former Kingsley, Iowa Police Chief has pled guilty to domestic abuse. Joseph Hoover, 52, filed his written plea Friday in Plymouth County District Court to one count of domestic abuse assault, a serious misdemeanor. Sentencing is scheduled for June 22nd. Hoover was arrested July 19 after the Plymouth County Sheriff's Office investigated a report of a possible case of domestic abuse in a Kingsley home about 6:30 a.m. that day. After arriving at the residence, deputies found a female victim with several injuries to her face and neck, according to court documents. The woman told deputies that Hoover had struck her with his forearm and shoulder, court documents said. Hoover was suspended with pay shortly after his arrest and later resigned. Man pleads not guilty to enticing minor, Sioux City. A Carnarvon, Iowa man has pled not guilty to enticing a girl under age 13 to his apartment and having sex with her. Nathan Landrum, 39, waived his personal appearance and entered his plea in writing Friday in U.S. District Court in Sioux City to one count of coercion or enticement of a female. Sac County Sheriff's deputies arrested Landrum April 30th after learning that the girl had been found locked in Landrum's apartment. The girl told authorities that Landrum had friended her on Facebook and was sending her sexual messages. According to a complaint filed in Sac County District Court, the girl had left her home and met with Landrum. The two had sex in his apartment just before the girl's mother arrived. Landrum initially was charged in Sac County District Court with third-degree sexual abuse and 5 counts of enticing a minor. Those charges were dismissed after his federal indictment. Man sentenced for sexually abusing a minor. Omaha. A Winnebago, Nebraska man was sentenced Friday to more than 3 years in federal prison for sexually abusing a female minor. Walter Hewlett, 32, had pled guilty in U.S. District Court in Omaha to sexual abuse of a minor. He was sentenced to 41 months in prison. According to the U.S. Attorney's Office, at an unknown time in the spring of 2018, Hewlett engaged or attempted to engage in a sexual act with a girl aged 12 to 16. Man sentenced for domestic assault, Omaha. A Walthill, Nebraska man was sentenced Monday to 8 years in federal prison for grabbing a woman by the neck during a domestic assault. Bernard Jackson, 44, was found guilty in a January trial in U.S. District Court in Omaha of strangulation and domestic assault by a habitual offender. Jackson became angry with the woman on October 30th and punched her in the back of the head 5 or 6 times and twice in the face, knocking her to the floor, before grabbing her by the neck with both hands to stand her up. The woman reported to authorities that after Jackson released her, she felt dizzy and could not breathe and fell onto a bed. Jackson then left the house. Jackson had been convicted of assaulting the same victim at least 4 times previously. Man faces charges after car burglaries. Spencer, Iowa. Spencer police arrested a Peterson, Iowa man Thursday on multiple felony charges related to car burglaries in Spencer. Following a foot chase, officers arrested Gary Stallings II, 40, on the 800 block of 14th Avenue West. Investigators determined Stallings had been involved in several car burglaries as well as 2 different vehicle thefts. He was also identified as using multiple credit debit cards that were stolen from the vehicles. Stallings was charged with ongoing criminal conduct, 4 counts of fraudulent use of credit cards, 2 counts of operating a motor vehicle with owner's consent, 2 counts of third-degree burglary, and interference with official acts. Stallings is being held at the Clay County Jail in Spencer. Spencer police were assisted by the Clay County Sheriff's Office and the Iowa State Patrol. Hot, steamy start to the work week. Sioux City. Expect a very hot and steamy day in Sioux City on Tuesday. The conditions will be repeated on Wednesday. Mostly sunny skies and a southerly breeze of 10 to 20 miles per hour will send Tuesday's mercury soaring to the mid-90s for a daytime high, according to Mike Gillespie, a hydrologist with the National Weather Service in Sioux Falls. 2 South Dakota races head for recounts. 2 legislative primary races in southeast South Dakota are headed for recounts. The Republican primaries for the District 7 Senate and District 19 House races both finished with narrow margins, according to the state election officials. The Yankton Press and Dakotan reports those vote differences each fell within 2% of the ballots cast, which qualifies under state law for a recount if the losing candidate requests it, which they did. In the District 17 Senate race, incumbent Art Rush of Vermilion defeated challenger Nancy Rasmussen of Hurley by 6 votes of nearly 2,000 cast. In the District 19 House race, incumbent Kent Peterson of Salem and challenger Jessica Baller of Alexandria claimed the 2 available spots with 1,881 and then 1,741 votes respectively. The third candidate, incumbent Overweg of New Holland, finished with 1,720 votes. Recounts must be completed within 14 days following the filing of the petition request. We'll now move to the sports section, and we'll begin with a column by Terry Hersom, who writes for the Journal. And the headline of his column today is "Respect the Rights of Iowa Players Who Have Spoken Out." I never gave much thought to rules many college coaches have enforced on athletes' use of social media. After the ruckus we've seen the last few weeks at the University of Iowa, I'm less surprised this kind of censorship seemed necessary. The way the years have flown by, at least before this one, it doesn't seem all that long ago that I was a college kid with more opinions than many older people wanted to hear about. A folk singer in my college days, I performed at rallies to protest the Vietnam War and push passionately for civil rights. I wasn't happy to see an older brother and countless friends sent to a remote corner of the world to put their lives on the line in a country where millions of oppressed citizens didn't really want our help. Nor was I happy with how good friends of color were often treated quite shabbily. That included a roommate who became the first president of what the University of Northern Iowa called its Afro-American Society. Decades later, we're still sending young Americans to battle in foreign lands where the risks that are taken are frequently unappreciated. And we still have many miles to go before racism isn't just a behavioral pattern restricted to a few supremely ignorant folks. I certainly respect the rights of a few Iowa Hawkeye football players who have spoken out passionately in the wake of several more acts of brutality to minorities, particularly the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. There is so much collateral damage when these things occur, and one example is the unfair light it casts upon law enforcement in America. The thousands of individuals who protect and serve us don't deserve it, and the focus needs to be on weeding out the unfit individuals who should never be issued a badge or a gun. Little is accomplished by the rioting that has taken place throughout the U.S. A video sent to me over the weekend shows that protests have gone off the rails, turning Manhattan, for example, into endless blocks of boarded-up storefronts. The looting that went with all of this doesn't exactly inspire any sort of progress on bringing all Americans together. Mindful that minorities are still suffering inexcusable bigotry on a significant scale, I respect the rights of all who speak out on Twitter or any other platform. That doesn't mean I agree with all that has been said or written or implied. Then again, all of us disagree with lots of people on many issues without making it personal. So, an Iowa defensive back says people who don't support whatever he and some of his teammates want or believe should find themselves another favorite team. I'm not sure a 20-year-old who grew up 18 miles from Ann Arbor should be impugning the loyalty of thousands who've been Hawkeye fans since long before he was born. This same individual insists it's all about the team, but what he has to say sounds an awful like it's about me, not all the others wearing the same uniform. Then there's a matter of using the national anthem as an opportunity to make a statement. If I'm reading it right, it seems as though Coach Kirk Ferentz, one of the best in the business, won't object if his entire team kneels while the Iowa Marching Band honors America. Colin Kaepernick, the former San Francisco 49ers quarterback, essentially gave up a fortune when he sat during the anthem at a preseason game in 2016 and then kneeled during this ritual throughout the regular season. Kaepernick's attempt at protesting racial injustice and police brutality proved highly offensive to millions of Americans. Not only did they fail to grasp what it all meant, they found it disrespectful to all the servicemen and women who'd given up their lives to defend our flag. I've never believed Kaepernick meant to say anything more than to make a statement about some of the worst social problems. He surely had to have known, though, that he'd be paying a price for some of the connotations many extracted from his behavior. Maybe the most unfortunate side to this story was that NFL teams had always stayed in their lockers during the anthem prior to 2009. The only exceptions had been the Super Bowl games and also the contests played after the weekend after 9/11. I'm reminded, too, of perhaps an even more dramatic protest from Mexico City Olympics in 1968. Following a 200-meter final in which San Jose State teammates Tommy Smith and John Carlos won gold and bronze. Both men raised a gloved fist as they stood on the podium for the U.S. anthem. Some believe Smith and Carlos were making a Black Power salute, but Smith insisted in his autobiography that the gesture was a human rights salute. The two men, now both 75, were students of a deceased friend of mine who was the head of the English department at San Jose State. That professor, the late Dr. John Galm, a native of Monito, Iowa, once told me that both were quite scholarly and personable. So this kind of communication, like the epidemic now wreaking havoc in our world, isn't anything new. In a country that prides itself in free speech, it would be best behoove us to accept any and all of it as best as we can. I'll now move to a story on the High School Metro Athlete of the Week, who is from Sergeant Bluff, Luton. And the headline is, Sergeant Bluff Luton's Emma Christensen thanks coaches and is a nightmare for pitchers. Every time Emma Christensen leaves practice, she makes sure to thank the coaches for their time. Sergeant Bluff Luton softball coach Jared Ocker said Christensen is just as polite in school, thanking teachers and treating her classmates with respect. Her attitude is second to none. She shows up and works hard and always says thank you to the coaches when she leaves. She's grateful for the chance to play, Ocker said. When I have been around her in school, it's not any different. It speaks volumes. She treats everybody on the field and in the building the same. She coaches the younger players up as they go. You can't ask for anything more out of a senior than to talk to an underclassman and help coach them up. For Christensen, it's common courtesy. Christensen says, I always grew up to be taught to be polite like that. And she is a senior for the Sergeant Bluff Luton softball team and this week's Metro Athlete of the Week. I am thankful for my coaches. They put in time outside of practice, so it is always important to thank them and know they are appreciated. However, opponents may not always see Christensen's polite side as she is tagging team after team for doubles off the wall, stealing a base, or driving in a teammate. She's a bit of a nightmare for opposing pitchers. I don't even know how to explain her value to the team. She's been hitting at the top of the order and leader behind the plate, Ocker said. Her career speaks for herself. Played in the state tournament as a freshman and a sophomore and an all-conference last year. She leads us in a lot of offensive categories. We would be a different team without her. This season will be Christensen's fifth with the Warriors, and ever since she's earned a spot SBL's varsity roster as an eighth grader, she's hit no lower than .345 and scored at least 20 runs each year. As Ocker puts it, it's all due to Christensen's hard work. She's looking for opportunities to practice. During quarantine, she was finding ways to work without getting in trouble. That's what makes her better. So when she gets the opportunity, she takes advantage of it. And that was a short story about the female Metro Athlete of the Week. We'll now move to a story on the male Metro Athlete of the Week. It's headline, Bishop Heelan's Brant Hoag returns after back injury. Brant Hoag is ready to prove himself. The Bishop Heelan High School senior is fortunate to have a chance to compete one last time with the Crusaders. Hoag will get the opportunity to take the mound on Tuesday night as the Class 3A top-ranked Crusaders start their season with a doubleheader at North High School. Hoag will pitch in Game 2 after junior Brett Sitzman, who will take the ball in the 5:30 p.m. start. Hoag says, I'm very excited. This is a long time coming. It's nice to see all the hard work I put in over the last 8 months pay off. No matter which game Hoag starts, he's happy he's put in the work throughout the school year to get to this point. Every Iowa high school student athlete has had to wait through the pandemic, but Hoag has had to wait longer than March to put a jersey on. The athletic school year started out fine for Hoag and had high expectations for Heelan's football and basketball teams. Hoag, Heelan's returning starter quarterback, started warming up for the Crusaders' season opener football game on August 30th against East at Elwood Olsen Stadium. Hoag has had back issues since he was a freshman, and those problems seemed to linger while the Heelan senior got loose for the game against the Black Raiders. He didn't think too much of the back spasm at the time, and he felt good in the practices leading up to the game. In the second quarter, Haug threw a hitch route, and he heard two pops in his back, which ended up being broken vertebrae. Once he felt that pop, he knew something was wrong, and he had to call an audible. "I could barely run," he said. "I knew my role for the rest of the game was to not be a runner at all." The Black Raiders ended up winning the game, and after the loss, Haug knew he had to get his back checked out. After he learned the status of his injury, he had two choices: expedite the rehab process and hopefully be back by the end of the basketball season, or wait until the baseball season to get his body fully healed. Haug did have some thought of returning early, but only if the Crusader boys basketball teams had a chance to make a deep run. Haug dressed and got on the floor for a brief minute during senior night during the basketball season, but the Crusaders didn't have as much success as the healing community expected. "It was smart to wait and play it safe," Haug said. Haug went to a rehabilitation three times a week, starting during the football season and lasting well into the winter. There were times when he admitted it was tough to find the motivation to go to rehab. "It was long and boring. Competing against myself for 6 months was annoying. It seemed like I was competing against myself. Every time I got down on myself, I realized why I was doing it. Once I figured out the reason why I was going, it was easier to go there every day. It popped into my brain that I got to go work hard for myself." The pain didn't immediately subside. It lingered even when Haug took off his back brace in December, which made him really nervous. "At that time, I was really scared I did that for no reason." Haug kept the faith, and the pain gradually went away. While he was sidelined, he felt he still had to make a contribution to the football and basketball teams. During the football season, he mentored freshman quarterback Luke Longvall to get him as ready as possible for the end of the 2019 season and to make sure he's ready for the upcoming 2020 season. In the winter, it was common for Haug to be seen in a shirt, tie, and navy slacks with a tablet in his hands. He kept many stats on the bench for the Crusaders boys basketball team. While Haug preferred to be in a navy uniform for Helan, he was happy to see his brother, senior Cole Haug, step up and perform well. It was cool to see Cole step up and embrace his role. Anytime he had a question about a play or if I would see something, he enjoyed having a player's perspective. Whenever he had a question, he knew I had been through that before. Haug never complained about his situation. Helan coach Andy Osborne says, "He's been the hungriest. He sacrificed an entire senior year. I feel sick for the kid." Toward the end of the basketball season, Haug started to pick up a baseball. He worked with the Helan training staff to find throwing programs. He threw five times a week. He started by throwing at 40 feet for 5 minutes a session. He started extending his throwing distance, and by the time spring rolled around, Haug was in the Briarcliff Charger practice dome, throwing long toss from end to end. He didn't rush into it. His body was 100% in terms of how his back was, but he also knew that throwing at 100% level wasn't productive. The Helan senior was expected to throw from the mound a week before the COVID-19 pandemic hit in March. He had to take a break like everyone else once the coronavirus stopped the sports world. "Everything shut down. Haug tried not to get down on himself again. I was upset. At first, I hoped this was blow over in a couple of weeks. Then 4 weeks before Governor Reynolds announced we could play, I was pretty doubtful. We just saw how many cases were spiking. I think during that time, I was thinking, man, I did all that work for nothing. It made me think that what if I played football and basketball?" And that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, June 16th. I'm Dagna, your reader for today, and you can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thank you for listening. Thank you.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. What exactly is fossil water, and why have we consumed so much of it? No, it's not a new brand of bottled water imported from the days of dinosaurs. Fossil water came from melting ice sheets, ancient lake systems, and a generally wetter climate tens to hundreds of thousands of years ago. It percolated into porous rocks, which were then buried under deep layers of sediment, where it was sealed off from the surface, and there it stayed, until farmers discovered it. And in the second half of the 20th century, they started drilling wells into fossil aquifers and pumping like mad, turning sunny, dry places into acres and acres of green farmland. Crop supplies boomed. Food became cheaper and more plentiful, grown in formerly parched places like California and Kansas, and shipped around the world for people like you and me to eat, ingesting fossil water with it. The trouble is, fossil water is a finite resource, and new studies suggest that many fossil aquifers may become depleted this century, so that we won't be able to rely on them any longer. This could mean that the crops that depend on them could become less plentiful and more expensive again. All the while, population will likely increase, the climate will likely warm, our demand for water will continue to climb, which means we'll have to adapt to the lack of fossil water, just as we adapted to its discovery, this time with more efficient crops and farming methods and more efficient use. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.